legally and lawfully are also being discriminated against in these bills.
I'm standing with the Madison County executive. She's Kathleen Falk. You have just filed suit. Where and against whom?
In the Dane County Circuit Court against the action that the state Senate Republicans took Wednesday evening in a flurry, violating the open meetings law without required notice and by acting without a quorum of the Senate to ram this down all of our throats.
Now, you're the county executive here in Dane County. The governor, Scott Walker, was a county executive in Milwaukee.
I've been a county executive for the last 14 years running Dane County. So I've been on both sides of the bargaining table, and I believe in collective bargaining. It is the right way to get things done, and you can get things done that protect taxpayers. Just in the last couple years alone, I have bargained with 9 unions, a cut in pay in 2009, a cut in pay in 2010, and more contributions to health insurance in 2011. We do it respectfully, and we got it done for our citizens. So you don't have to eliminate collective bargaining rights in order to protect taxpayers.
We're at the state capitol. Well over 100,000 people are here. Placards, American flags, rainbow flags, union flags of every stripe. And right on the corner is the State Historical Museum. That's very relevant because Madison, Wisconsin is the home of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. It was formed in 1932 at the height of the Great Depression. This is the place where unions have fought for weekends, for the 40-hour work week. It's what FDR was speaking about in his fireside chats. Madison, Wisconsin is a historic site, not only in 1932, but today in 2011. Many see it as ground zero for, well, what one sign says, the shock doctrine.
Saturday's protest in Madison was the largest in Wisconsin history. It came one day after Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker signed into law the controversial bill, Act 10, a piece of legislation that sharply curbs collective bargaining rights for most public employees in the state of Wisconsin. Protesters in the Capitol building rushed to the entrance of the governor's conference room when they heard the governor would be coming to the Capitol. Their chants of "We're still here" echoed throughout the building and inside the ornate room where the signing took place. Governor Walker told reporters he hopes Wisconsin will inspire other states to pass similar laws. Ironically, inlaid in the center of the ceiling of the ornate chamber where the signing took place, the words were written in gold, "The will of the people is the law of the land." And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shreve Habdokadous, Aaron Mate, Renee Phelps, Nermaine Sheikh, Dina Guzdar, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Curran, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, Jessel Noor, Jessica Lee, Ryan Devereaux, Vesta Gudars, and our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Rob Campani, Kellan Innocent. Again, our website is democracynow.org, where you can get all the latest from the Middle East to the Midwest. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Terra Informa, your source for your environmental news. I'm Andy Reid, your host for this week's show of Terra Informa, the community-based environmental news program heard across Canada. From the shores of Lake St. Clair in Windsor, Ontario, to the congested seaport of the Vancouver Harbour, Terra Informa will be there to make sure you know of the developments that impact our great land. Today on Terra Informa, we are bringing you a special episode, This week, we're focusing on the most regal of our Canadian icons. No, I'm not talking about beer. This week, we'll shine the radio spotlight on the environmental, social, and economic factors at play in the diminishing caribou populations. In order to provide adequate coverage of this important topic, we will be skipping our regular news headlines, and instead, we'll plunge headfirst into the subject of caribou biology with Terra Informa correspondent Rebecca Rooney.
Although in recent years, it seems like they'll put anything on the back of a quarter, the caribou remains one of Canada's most recognized national symbols, right up there with Mounties and beaver. Sadly, they are a national symbol in decline. We here at Terra Informa are therefore dedicating this entire episode to the plight of Canadian caribou. We take stock of our two most numerous subspecies and the human-induced pressures on their populations. We also look at the social and economic effects of declining caribou herds. But to start off, we need to understand a little bit about their ecology. The barren ground caribou are the most numerous subspecies. They occupy most of Nunavut, the Northwest Territories, and northern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. The barren ground caribou are well known for their epic seasonal migrations. During winter, bulls and cows stay in separate herds, calves with their mothers. They settle in the forest, where they feed on lichens growing beneath the snow. In spring, the herds rejoin and commence their migration across the tundra to the calving grounds. Cows separate from the herds to calve, and then rejoin the bulls for summer on the tundra, feeding on grasses and other tundra vegetation. After the fall mating season, the caribou again disperse for winter in the forests. The woodland caribou are the most broadly dispersed subspecies. They can be found in every province and territory except Nunavut, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and New Brunswick. Because of their broad distribution, the woodland caribou are divided into different ecotypes depending on where they live. Like barren grounds caribou, all woodland caribou feed mainly on lichens, although in summer they might also feed on grass, moss, and other plants. Both the woodland and the barren ground subspecies are in decline. Kasiwik designated the barren ground caribou as a species of special concern in 2004, and the woodland caribou as threatened in 2002. Although both subspecies are understood to be in decline, they are not declining for the same reasons. Here is Dr. Fiona Schmigelow, a caribou biologist and director of the Northern Environmental and Conservation Sciences Program at the University of Alberta.
Woodland caribou, from their historic distribution, have declined about 50% in terms of the area that they occupy and probably also their numbers. That's sort of since the turn of the century. And that's mostly got to do with changes in land use patterns, loss of habitat along the southern periphery of their range, in conjunction with the expansion of humans into these areas. Also increasing harvest pressures from humans in some areas. Over the last few decades, the pressures have had more to do with land use change further north in the range. So industrial activities in the boreal forest associated with forest harvesting, energy sector development in Western Canada, primarily to do with oil and gas expansion. In Eastern Canada, a bit more to do with hydroelectric developments and those sorts of things.
But humans aren't just having direct effects on woodland caribou by destroying their habitat. We're also having indirect effects.
The two major factors are first the change in the amount and distribution of the forest, such that we tend to see more younger forest coming in with industrial development, and that increases numbers of moose and deer, which then increases the numbers of predators, which means that there's increased predation pressure on caribou. So that's sort of the amount issue. The distribution issue has to do with the fact that we tend to fragment these landscapes, which also creates smaller patches of the remaining older forest, which is what caribou generally prefer. And so then we see increased overlap between caribou and moose and their predators. And so essentially what that means is that some of these predators, wolves in particular, can move much more efficiently around the landscape. Their chances of encountering caribou are much greater, and so their chances of killing caribou are greater.
In contrast to the steady decline we've observed in woodland caribou numbers, learning from native elders and using aerial survey methods, researchers discovered long ago that barren grounds caribou populations naturally undergo large fluctuations. So even though, according to Kasiwik, most barren grounds herds are currently at about 25% of their historic population levels, it's difficult to say whether the decline is part of a natural cycle or is due to human impacts.
Barren ground caribou have undergone large fluctuations over the course of decades, and we have certainly been at a low point across herds in northern Canada. And many of them are not yet showing recovery from those declines. There is an exception to that, and it was a little bit of a surprise to everyone. There was a survey of the porcupine caribou herd. There'd been unsuccessful attempts for a number of years. And instead of declining from the previous number of 120,000 animals, there were fears that it had gone down to 100,000 or perhaps even as low as 80,000. The recent count just at the end of last week was up to almost 170,000 animals. So it actually seems to be on the increase now. The other herds, as I said, have not shown the same sort of recovery.
And although their populations do naturally fluctuate, part of the reason we haven't seen recovery may be because of increasing human development in northern Canada.
We've seen increasing development pressures across the north in Canada, and particularly in the Northwest Territories over the last few decades. We've seen the expansion of the road network with some of the major developments, and in particular the presence of year-round roads that perhaps were just winter roads before. And these road networks can have a number of effects on caribou, both through direct avoidance and through increasing harvest pressure. And so, you know, those are threats, if you like, that historically didn't exist in those areas. So that makes us much less certain as to whether we will see the same sorts of recovery in the northern herds that you would expect under a natural cycle.
Barren ground caribou are actually the subspecies most closely interlinked with humans. Many people, even today, rely on them.
You know, across the north in Canada, many of the human populations there have a very close association with the barren ground caribou and still do harvest fair numbers of caribou and rely on them, in fact, for food for the winter. So that harvest pressure can be quite significant on the barren ground caribou, but that's been present for some time. Now, there's questions as to whether that's increased recently in association with the expansion of road networks. You know, unfortunately, we don't have very good records in some cases of what the historic human harvest levels have been, but it is something that is being monitored fairly closely now.
But if the harvest has been going on for centuries, even with increased access from permanent roads, it seems unlikely to be responsible for the decline in caribou numbers.
The increasing pressure on the barren ground caribou from human influences comes with the increased industrial development and access associated with that. And that can bring a host of potentially negative effects on the caribou herd with respect to avoidance of areas of development and increased local pressures on harvest that would not have traditionally happened.
The current pressures that we're seeing in association with human activities and with climate change as well are exacerbating the pressures that would naturally have occurred on these populations. So we need to be cautious in undertaking our activities.
So even though caribou may all look the same on the back of a quarter, we can see that Canada's two dominant caribou subspecies live incredibly different lifestyles in their respective parts of the country. Whereas the woodland caribou live in small, sedentary groups and have experienced a steady decline in numbers that most researchers attribute to industrial activity and increased predator access, barren grounds caribou exist in giant migrating herds and have historically fluctuating populations. It may be that human development is not wholly responsible for recent declines in barren grounds caribou, but if that regal beast goes extinct, will it really matter if our actions only compounded a natural, climate-driven population crash? Probably not. For more sides of this caribou issue, stay tuned to Terra Informa. Back over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Rebecca. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Terra Informa, produced in Edmonton, Alberta at CJSR and heard across Canada. In this week's special episode, we are focusing on the important issue of Canadian caribou populations. Loss of caribou is not just a concern for environmentalists. Many Aboriginal communities depend on caribou as an important food source, and these disappearing animals also play a role in cultural life. Correspondent David Karchin spoke to Brenda Parley, a sociologist who has studied the impact of caribou decline in the Northwest Territories. To begin with, she gave us a sense of how large the decline has been.
Bathurst caribou has declined by 95%, so from around 450,000 animals to around 30,000 animals. So we're talking about a massive decline in that particular herd.
That's Brenda Parley, sociologist at the University of Alberta. When an important species such as caribou becomes threatened, is it an ecological crisis or a social crisis? After all, the caribou is a major source of sustenance for thousands of people. Dr. Parley has been asking this question for some time and documenting the impact of such environmental change on Aboriginal people in the north, people she has worked with as a researcher for many years. It's worth pointing out here that we're mainly talking about barren ground caribou, found far to the north of the country. The science of caribou decline is complicated by the fact that barren ground caribou population numbers fluctuate naturally anyhow. I started by asking Dr. Parley about this.
We know from both traditional knowledge and from science that these oscillations in numbers happen every 30 to 70 years. Some people believe that that actually isn't a decline, that the caribou have essentially gone somewhere else, that there's a couple hundred thousand caribou.
Just missing caribou
missing.
Somewhere out
yes.
in the,
missing,
the
which,
wilderness. Well, either way, for the for communities, whether the caribou are dead or whether they haven't come, it might be a moot point because obviously they don't have the caribou available
right.
when they usually would.
Right.
What are some of the social implications of this missing caribou?
The biggest concerns are around food security and the impact that it has on diet. Most of the communities in the Inuvialuit, Saulteaux, and Gwich'in region depend heavily on barren ground caribou. So there's three things that people end up doing in these situations. One is they work harder to find caribou. The second is, of course, shifting what they're eating in terms of traditional diet. So eating more moose meat, eating more fish, eating other kinds of traditional food.
Are there health effects? Is a diet of caribou superior to a diet, to the substituted diet?
Right. If people are not eating traditional food, including caribou, and instead they're substituting with food from the store, that substitution with pork bellies from southern Manitoba or pizza, that has implications for diet, especially in communities where there's concerns for diabetes.
Do caribou have a particular cultural importance to some of these communities, which is now disappearing with the caribou?
Some communities and harvesters talk about themselves in terms of that identity. We are caribou people. A friend of mine had caribou and they were cutting up the meat within the house, and I had come in to stay with them for a few days, and the little boy came up to me and said, "Don't be worried, we're caribou people. You know, this is all very normal and important part of our way of life." So even for young children who may not be perceived by the average public as there's a hunter, even small children talk about themselves as caribou people. On the flip side, you also have this perception that this has happened before and this decline is creating new opportunities for us to develop other skills around hunting of other species. Colleagues of mine talking about going on trails that they haven't ever been on before, that the last time people went on those trails was when the caribou were gone, and so now they're going to different places to look for traditional foods.
Are there implications for territory? Do people define their land based on where the caribou are?
Because the caribou range is dynamic, people's historic traditional territories were also dynamic. So certain communities have affinity for the Beverly herd or the Bathurst herd, and other communities have the affinity for the porcupine herds. So you have, yes, affinity or connection between home for people and home for caribou.
We're talking about barren ground caribou with sociologist Brenda Parley. Specifically, we're talking about the social impacts of when the herds of these animals go missing. I finished up by asking about the role of hunting versus other factors as potential causes for the caribou decline.
The big concerns we have are around the emphasis that gets placed within policy by managers and within the media or the public on hunting as the primary problem, when in fact there are these other bigger issues of resource development and climate change. It's harder for people to get their head around these more abstract influences on populations. It's easier to look at the individual with the rifle as the culprit. The Aboriginal people today are hunting a fraction, a small, small fraction of what they would have historically hunted.
Brenda Parley, been great to have you on the show today, and thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, David. You're listening to a special edition of Terra Informa. This week, we are investigating the environmental, social, and economic factors that affect caribou population. So far, we've heard from scientists and academics. Now we go to the north to speak to people who live off the land and find out what they've seen. Steve Anderson interviewed two hunters from the Northwest Territories for their perspective on the current state of the caribou herds.
Thanks, Andy. This week I spoke to James Marlowe and Jonas Sangris, both of whom hunt caribou in the Northwest Territories. James lives in Litsike on the eastern arm of Great Slave Lake. That's about 150 kilometers due east of Yellowknife on the opposite shore of the lake. Jonas is from Detta, which is much less isolated. It's only about 20 minutes from Yellowknife. Both men rely on caribou for a large part of their diet and also provide meat to members of their extended families. I asked them how many caribou they require in a typical year.
When I had my family, my parents were alive, and I usually take about 10 to 15 a year. Now, for my family, I only take maybe 5 a year, maybe not even that.
I usually get 5 to 6 per trip, maybe 15 to 20 per year. And that feeds my family and my mother's household. My mother is an elder, and I tend to provide her with meat. Most people grew up with caribou. We were raised on it, and it's our main staple of food. In the past, we used to, have caribou meat all the time. Now, because of the caribou being so far and only a few people get them, so it's kind of difficult on the elders, especially elders who cannot hunt anymore, and also the single people, young families. It's difficult for them to obtain caribou meat.
James says that for Litsike, problems began with the construction of enormous diamond mines within the caribou's migration corridor.
Well, we noticed the changes starting back maybe 10 to 13 years ago, when the big diamond rush started happening here in our backyard. BHP, Diavik, and Snap Lake, and now Gachoku. Those are the four diamond mines. Well, three in production and fourth on the way. And those diamond mines are right in our traditional area. And for an example, Diavik is situated right in the main migration path. They have maybe a couple of thousand kilometers of ice route. And one year when Diavik and Snap Lake were being constructed, 12,000 truckloads went up there. That's 12,000 trucks. And when you have that many trucks on an ice road at one time, it's just like creating a fence where the ice road is. Caribou used to go around there before, but now they go elsewhere. They go further east from our community. It's been many years since we saw caribou on a lake. They're more scattered away from Litsike. Nowadays, we have to go maybe 200 to 300 kilometers from our community, and we have to travel many hours and sometimes days to get our food.
I asked Jonas what he thought was causing the declines in caribou populations.
I asked the elder why those caribou are declining. He said it's a cycle thing. He said, a few years, there's no caribou, then they'll come back. Same thing with the rabbit, he said.
It goes up and down the caribou herd, and that's what the elders say in the community. Sometimes, not too much, but, there's a little bit of decline, but it always comes back. But the decline this time is hardly coming back.
As we heard earlier in the show, scientists are concerned that there may be more at play than just natural cycling of caribou numbers. Whether that's the case or not, the government's concerned, and in response, they've enacted hunting bans. And that's been hard on people who rely on the caribou.
The hunting ban really affects us. From Litsike, anyways, on the north shore of the east arm, that's where the boundary is on the ban. I know that if there's caribou there, people are going to go there and hunt just, to feed their families and exercising their treating Aboriginal rights. We've been here for thousands of years, relied on caribou for our survival. Although there's a ban, I know people are going to go hunting. Even myself, I will.
Well, that's exactly what Jonas did last spring.
Yeah, they confiscated all my caribou meat. Saturday, I went hunting early in the morning, brought back 6 to my cabin, cleaned it and everything. About 12:31, come back and I was unloading it and cooking Sam. Next thing I know, Game Warden came. He and I said, well, sorry, Jonas, we have to confiscate all your meat.
Today we focused a lot on the scientific aspects of the caribou decline, but it's important to remember the human impacts too. For people who live off the land, caribou are a critical resource. Policymakers find themselves in a difficult position, concerned that they need to act quickly to ensure caribou numbers recover, and yet having to be very mindful of the consequences of their decisions for the territory's hunters and their families. For Terra Informa, I'm Steve Anderson. Back to you, Andy.
Thanks, Steve. To wrap up today's show, we have to consider the financial implications of preserving our caribou. What would it cost to save herds of caribou, and how can it be achieved at the best value to taxpayers? Terra Informa correspondent Dana Harper went looking for some answers and filed this report.
Ever taken a close look at a quarter? Careful observers of Canada's currency will be familiar with the caribou head gracing the reverse of our 25-cent piece. In fact, there's far more caribou stamped on coins than there are roaming the northern plains. But even those metallic caribou are down in numbers these days, with the introduction of the Alberta Centennial coin, which replaced the caribou with, you guessed it, an oil derrick. A cruel irony, we thought, given the role of resource development in the demise of this animal. But on the topic of money and caribou, conservation programs for this animal are expensive. So far on today's program, we've looked at the threats this iconic animal faces and the implication of their decline for Aboriginal communities in the north. But what's being done about it? According to scientists, not enough. However, there is some good news. A plan called the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement was signed last year by industry and environmental organizations, protecting forests from logging and road building in strategic caribou habitats. Also, most provinces have set out conservation plans, although just how effective these will be remains to be seen. But scientists say more effort will be needed, and more effort costs more money. To give us an idea of just how much money, we spoke with University of Alberta economist Vic Adamowicz. Dr. Adamowicz's research team is analyzing the economic trade-offs between resource development and woodland caribou conservation. Their work focuses on the woodland caribou of Alberta. There are two different kinds of costs associated with caribou conservation. One kind of cost is the direct cost, which includes activities such as reforestation and predator control. Another kind of cost is called opportunity cost, and this refers to the monetary value of not allowing resource extraction on an area of land and thus not allowing the royalties and jobs from such extraction to be realized. Thus, the direct costs refer to activities, while the opportunity costs refer to restrictions on resource extraction. We asked our guest to comment on what these costs might look like.
There's a fair amount that we can do for caribou at relatively low cost, at very small amounts of money, let's say per taxpayer. As you try to do more and more for caribou, it's going to get increasingly expensive, especially on the opportunity cost side, because it would mean restrictions on energy sector activity, particularly activity in the oil sands areas.
What are some of those very cheap options for conserving caribou?
Some of them are, for example, the predator control and even some of the enhanced regeneration of forest lands. A part of it is just making sure it's in areas that don't have other resources, so the opportunity costs are very low of those areas. So we could do a fair amount, as I say, for very little, just by making sure that those areas are made friendly for caribou. So it depends in a sense of how we measure it. One of the challenges with caribou conservation is it's something that's going to take time. The way the populations are trending right now, it's going to be several years before we bring the populations back to what we would think of as a self-sustaining status. So that's in fact one of the difficulties, is what level do we want to bring caribou herds back to and then declare that they are now self-sufficient or self-sustaining in a region? How many herds do we want to do that across all the herds in the province to try to bring them all back to self-sustaining levels? That would be actually a much more expensive approach if we tried to do all herds at self-sustaining status, compared to, say, trying to make sure there's sufficient habitat, which may not generate self-sustaining herds. Those will involve different kinds of costs, orders of magnitude different.
And what kind of numbers are we talking about?
We're looking at potentially hundreds of millions in opportunity costs over a 30 to 50 year period versus very small amounts for some of the herds that have low opportunity cost and won't need a lot of effort to try to protect.
This is Terra Informa, and we are talking to Vic Adamowicz, an environmental economist from the University of Alberta. We're discussing what it might cost to save the woodland caribou, a threatened species in the province of Alberta.
To what extent has industry been prepared to make sacrifices to their bottom line for the sake of caribou?
Over the past several years, there are things that industry has been doing. They are trying to implement beneficial management practices